Welcome to Breeders Syndicate, where we explore the history of a clandestine scene through the eyes of the folks who lived it. I'm Matthew, owner of Riot Seeds. I'll occasionally be joined by my co-host Not-So-Dog, breeder and grower from Mendocino. Welcome to the underground.
So we thought today we would talk about like different parts of growing and flower and like what it means for you. So we'll try to, there'll be times where maybe we'll get a little technical, but we'll try to make it topical and bring it back to stuff that, because there's a lot of different ways of growing. There's a lot of different ways of, you know, there's a lot of methods, right?
Yeah.
And if there's anything in weed that leads people to religion, it's the way that I grow is the best way.
Yeah.
And I have the best pot because of this method. Right. And so it gets really hard to debate any part about it because there's so much pride, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's like art, you know, everybody's got ego with their art. And if someone tells you that, you know, it could be done a little bit better, it hurts something, you know? So yeah, definitely.
And you know, there's aspects of too, of like, you know, one size fits all.
In
the sense of depending on what your goals are, and we'll break it down into chunks, whether you're breeding or whether you're growing for pure heads or whether you're trying to grow commercially on a bit larger of a scale, like there's different pros and cons to your approach. They're not all the same. So it's really hard to be like, oh, I just need to learn this one thing. And this method, if I perfect it, will consistently do the best for me no matter what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
No,
just really not the case, you know. And then we could talk a little bit about like what those methods do to the flower.
Sure.
And some misnomers maybe about how everybody thinks that like nutrition is like the only thing really that messes with it, but there's temperature and there's spectrum and there's how you treat it afterwards and all that kind of goes into it.
Yeah.
You know? You know, and so as a result of that, there's a lot of people trying a lot of good ways to grow cannabis that they're not putting all the pieces together.
Yeah. You know, one of the most common questions I get in relation to nutrients and in feed is, when people email me about a specific strain, they'll ask like, hey, how do I feed it? What's it like? And I try to explain to them the difference between like, you know, it depends. It all depends. I don't even know what expression, you know, you're going for. I don't know what expression the plant's going to give in the first place in your environment. So it's really hard to tell people how you're going to feed because it's not just strain dependent. It's individual plant and individual rooms dependent. And I think it'd be a good way to illustrate it. Talking about it.
It matters. It's like trying to be like, well, this, if you just do this, like you can pick up any woman you want.
Yeah.
You know, this dating method is just 100% effective.
Yeah.
And doesn't take the other human being into account, you know? Yeah. And I also thought like, this is a little esoteric, but there's like there's this really cool book by this, he writes for the New York Times or whatever. And his name's Michael Pollan. And it's called The Botany of Desire.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's a great book and documentary.
And it's a you know, it's like a plant's eye view from the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought maybe too, like we rarely talk about like what cannabis or hemp or whatever wants.
Yeah.
Like what it's trying to do and what it's going for. Because in order for us to get what we want, right, we have to play with what it's doing.
Yeah.
To convince it to give us what we're after.
Yeah. Because what it wants isn't necessarily what our end product of smoking it is.
No. And I mean, in some cases, you know, like, I mean, basically at its most basic level, the plant wants to mate, create seed, continue the progeny of itself. It has zero interest in creating good smoke for us.
Yeah, that's not
seedless. Seedless is failure genetically to it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of stuff that plays into that, you know, and we just thought that, you know, like we listen to a lot of these things and we hear a lot of discussions, and mostly what I see is a bunch of people. No offense, I'm not trying to piss anybody off, but like patting themselves on the back for what method they've chose.
Yeah.
And that's the superior method. And people aren't really interested in hearing different opinions about things too much.
Yeah.
You know, it's very cliquish.
It is very cliquish.
Whether you're a salt farmer, ooh, or you use bottles. You know?
I mean, right there, like bottle people, or, you know, that's kind of faux pas right now. Organic's the way, you know, like
not only organics, but no bottles organic.
Yes, no bottles organic.
No bottles. KNF, living soil, you know, full salts, Synganic. Yeah. You know, there's all the, all these different things play into it. And then like, and I, you know, I mean, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding that goes into all of it.
Yeah.
Right. And so you hear all these, there's all these talks. I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm some, you know, there's other more intelligent people that can talk about like the pure nutrition aspect of it. I can give a general overview that'll probably work, but mostly what we're talking about is like end results and how to manipulate your plants to get what you want.
Yeah.
Right. And there's different goals and it's not all the same.
Yeah. I mean, you know? like I've talked about this a lot in the past. Choosing for selection, a lot of when I choose a plant for selection or for keepers, I'm choosing a plant for keepers for breeding, you know, whereas someone else's keeper may not be that because they're looking for an immediate production plant that has all the traits they want right there. I want something that's going to have the traits that it passes down as opposed to what it's showing up in itself. You know,
yeah, Neville and some the old timers used to talk about that sometimes the best breeders were not the plant that they would put into production from that same line.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Very different
and
things.
They could be the same and they could also just end up being different. We end up breeding with production plants.
Yeah.
Because those are what survived.
Yeah.
For the most part, you know? You know, trying to, you know, it's not like there's a bunch of, even amongst traders and collectors like ourselves, you're not trading old males.
Yeah.
Right.
No,
but you're not getting like, oh, that's the 98 male of this and this, you know, like, no, that doesn't, you're lucky if like, you know, you get a female from that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody keeping old males like that from, the Dutch days.
No, I mean, some of them do, but they're certainly never going to trade them for you. They view them as like the bedrock of their company.
Oh, so much G13 haze mill. That's one. That's one that did make it out now that I think it's about it. I don't know if it's still around. Yeah.
But yeah, rare.
Yeah, very rare.
Rare. You know,
and now, one example.
Now with STS and stuff like that, it's even become more rare because they've eliminated the male in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe we could give it, we could start because it is a little rambly or whatever, but. We could start maybe with like, what's your goal? So like, I was going to break it down basically into like three, like big chunks, right? Yeah. There's like growing for you, which is basically trying to make it as heady as possible and usually relatively small scale. Then there's growing for seed. And then there's growing at a larger scale for production.
Yeah.
And there's various grades and levels of that. And that's a lot of what people are faced with today in terms of like how do you scale up headies?
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's been a major, major problem for people.
Yeah. And people are realizing that like, oh, like, you know, this method that I've done for 20 years, it's worked great in my two greenhouses.
Yeah.
Well, now I've got 6 10,000 square foot licenses and my weed's not as nice.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people convinced themselves at the beginning of REC that they were totally going to be able to scale up. You know, like it shouldn't be hard, you know, right?
Yeah,
and it just didn't work out that way.
And not only from a difficulty standpoint, but also certain things that might be perfectly economically feasible at a certain scale, you know, inputs that you might be using or whatever, might not scale up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the amount of liquid you're going to go through and the amount of this and the amount of that and the amount of labor it might entail.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and so all those things play into it. Right. So maybe we'll just start real general and we'll talk about like the difference between like growing good weed and growing for seed.
Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
So, you know, if you're trying to grow for good weed these days, that means seedless. So that means you're going to trick the plant into constantly going, waiting for pollen that never comes.
Yes.
Right. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to give it, you know, enough nitrogen, enough veg or boost or whatever, and to get it to a certain size, get it to flower set, and then grow good flower, harvest it, smoke it. That's your gig.
Yeah.
Right. And so that requires a certain kind of nutrition, right? Where if you're growing from seed, you're planning on pollinating it, right? And then since it's going to be making babies like seeds inside itself, you'll probably give it a lot more nitrogen and you'll give it a lot more of a mix that is very different than if you'd smoke it.
Yeah, I tend to feed heavy nitrogen during flower for seeds. I feed it like tomatoes. A very tomato regimen is great for seeds, keeping them healthy and viable. But I flip out like if people feed sinsimilla like that, because it just, to me, it just ruins it, you know, when you just flood it with nitrogen for the most part.
I mean, and so maybe there's an aspect that people should realize here. So one of the interesting things is there's this, I'll give a plug. There's this company called Canna, okay?
Yeah.
Which is a Dutch company that designed nutrition for cannabis, mm-hmm. right? And the reason why they're special is that for a super long time when people were developing nutrition, they couldn't test it on cannabis because it was illegal.
Yeah.
But Canna could. So mm-hmm. Canna, you know, they were able actually to grow different plants, you know, cannabis different ways, and then test how the plant actually uptook nutrient, right? Yeah. So they had this method of like, give it just enough and nothing more.
Yeah.
Right? Where like, I would say American companies are more supersize me, like we'll sell the customer way more than they need.
Like advanced, the 32 product fucking suite.
Yeah, or, you know, general hydroponic, you know, I just mean like the usage rates. It's okay. Like, go heavy, put a bunch in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens with, you know, from a plant's perspective, right? You know, plants will sit there and what they want to do is they have no idea that there's like humans taking care of them really, right? So they want to soak up as much food as they possibly can within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the food starts to run low, they have enough left inside themselves to like carry on the process of making seed.
Yes.
Right? So like back in the day, you see a lot of people that are like, oh, I want to pack on weight on my flower, right? And mm-hmm. they would like give boosters or something heavy at the end.
Yeah.
And then you end up with unused nutrient in your stuff. And what Canna mm-hmm. figured out is that if you gave it at the like early mid part of flower, say like week 3 on a 10-week strain, right? Yeah. Then the plant would have the next month to use up that excess.
Yeah.
And grow all that flower and boost itself. And then it would still be running out, running low towards the end.
Yeah.
Because what you want is, since you're going to trick the plant and you're never going to seed it, you don't want a bunch of that excess stored inside the plant itself.
No.
In general.
You don't want to do that. No.
Right? And so that's what happens sometimes when people like quote unquote pump it, or they ride a high EC, or they mm-hmm. have a lot of organic nutrition that's like their soil's hot.
Yeah.
The plant just soaks up a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a bunch in there because it's trying to make sure when it runs out, it has enough to make seed.
Yeah.
It doesn't know you're going to make seedless.
Yeah.
So you have to like plan your nutrition around what you're trying to do.
Yeah, like if a plant knew that it was going to be seedless, it would probably not put so much energy into making the little hairs, you know?
No, yeah. And I mean, you know, like our buddy, you know, CSI, who grows in beds in his rooms that he makes seed. I mean, he puts enough nutrition in there for 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
He mostly feeds water.
Yeah.
Because he's not concerned, and it's really high nitrogen. It's not something he would ever do if he was growing for flower for market.
Yeah.
It's like a completely different mix. And that's why it's so bunk. You know, when he talks about like when it fails, people act like, oh, well, then you just got a bunch of good heady weed.
Yeah, no.
And he's like, no, I got a bunch of overly nitrogened, you know, it's not going to burn the right way. Like, it's not going to come out heads because it was a mix for seed creation.
Yeah.
You know, and to grow heads, you kind of want to give the plant everything that it needs, and then ideally let it use up its excess before you're done.
Yeah. And it's like also why he doesn't show a lot of pictures of the actual seed process making, because it's not pretty. Like, to feed it correctly, to have it making healthy seeds, it's not a visually appealing plant, you know?
No.
And some people, and the majority of people wouldn't understand that part. They don't get the great job
of making thick, healthy tiger striped seeds that are going to be good for customers, but it's not going to look pretty. Where if he has different rooms, for instance, that he's using to do like seed pops and experiments, and he's going to like pheno hunt and see what they are, those soil beds will be mixed at a different ratio.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be a lot less nitrogen. You know, it'll be a lot more scaled for flour.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, there's other aspects too, where it's like plants really are like people in the sense that, you know, you've got your friends that can eat whatever they want and like, you know, and they stay thin as a rail, and you got your plants that like look at a potato chip and gain 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. Plants do that same thing. They eat at different rates.
Yeah.
They have different feeding requirements. They have different root systems. They drink different. And so what becomes hard is like, you know, I've always thought when I was doing bigger shit that you're trying to put plants that drink the same and eat the same in the mm-hmm. same area.
Yeah.
Right? Because I've had situations where I'm burning one plant or one line and the other mm-hmm. line wants more food.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you know, anytime I have Urkel in the room, that's going on.
or you know, you're trying to grow something that drinks a lot and really fast versus something that like drinks slower like Kush, and you don't need to water that thing as much, so you end up overwatering it to compensate, you know. And that's what makes like that's honestly like people diss monocropping, but that's why a lot of people like to monocrop.
Yeah,
because you can dial in your nutrient regimen or how you're feeding your plant or your style, right? Yeah. To fit that crop. Like we have a good buddy, Pip, Souvenir Seed Co. or whatever. And he talks about, you know, he was at our party one year. Remember he was blown away by how good that diesel was.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it was, you know, the cut was from him at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was used to putting one or two in the corner and he couldn't feed it the way he'd feed a whole room of sour.
Yeah.
So it would come out nice, but not perfect.
Yeah.
You know, because it's one of those things where it had different requirements than the rest of the stuff he was doing.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't come out as nice.
Yeah. Sour is also one of those where it's like, fucking, you miss it, you miss it.
Yeah, it's
it's finicky. Very easy to miss.
You know, it's finicky. And so, you know, there's an aspect to that where people think that there's a one size fits all. There's a one method. They can take the method they know and apply it to anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start to see there's these like A5 and C5 and the cough and PIF and Cuban black haze are starting to gain in popularity or even GMO, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to have a plant that takes 12 to 15 weeks, you're going to have to feed it differently than a plant that takes 8 to 10.
Yep.
You're going to have to veg it for longer. You're going to have to give it a different mix. And just so people know, it's not like the mix dictates what happens to the plant. The mm-hmm. plant's trying to feed on what it wants.
Yeah.
And it's either there or it's not. And I think that's a misconception. Like, maybe we could talk about that for a second, where like the plant absorbs salts.
Yes.
That's what it absorbs, right? So if you're feeding GH or, you know, I don't know, you know, Eagle or 20-20-20 or, you know, or any kind of salt or liquid chem nutrition, mm-hmm. you're giving it like the 17 major and macro elements, like in like an IV basically.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're fully organic, you're still feeding it those same salts. It's just, they're in longer chains. So you have to get various bacteria and fungi and stuff to break it down.
Yeah.
Make it available. Right. Yeah. And so like people don't get that. They're like, oh, you know, the plant. And if you break it, if you took a perfectly derived organic salt and a salt that GH or Cutting Edge or somebody throws in their mix, mm-hmm. you couldn't tell the difference under a microscope.
Yeah, I don't even know. About
like, even if you were a soil scientist, you couldn't, right? Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean they're the same thing. That's not true. So it's like, because like, basically like, you know, chem is like, you know, our understanding of what the plant needs. Yeah. Organic is more like if you get it perfect, it gives the plant everything that it needs. And then there's a bunch of like relationships with the soil itself that like it likes and we don't really understand.
You know, I have a question. I have a question for you. So I am not worldly or knowledgeable about organic feeding. I've always been like a house and garden can of type dude, bottles.
Sure.
And that's just what I rocked with, you know? So when you want to force the plant to drink what you want it, when you're doing organics, do you just do something to lower the pH or raise the pH to?
No, you have to, you basically, when you're doing organics, there's different approaches. Like there's bottles, like for instance, like to use the same thing, canna, biocanna. If you buy mm-hmm. organic bottles, you're essentially yeah. buying things where like the company has taken the time to sort of like cook it or ferment it or brew it or whatever method.
Yeah.
And those salts are more available than just adding raw amendments to the earth.
Okay. Yeah.
So like, for instance, if you're going to be that kind of guy where you're going to get soil and you want to amend it, a mm-hmm. lot of times you would get it and all you want to do is raw amendments. You'd probably get it, add your raw amendments and let it cook for a month or two before you'd even ever use it.
Yeah.
You know, and then because what you're trying to do is you're trying to like get all that bacteria and fungi and everything time to break down the organic food in there and yeah. make it available. Right. Cause that's the issue. Right. So the big difference is like when you feed salt, you can guarantee that the plant, the availability is there.
Yeah.
If the temperature is right and the pH is right and the mix is right in your salt, it's going to get all that food. In organics, okay. you're hoping that food is there.
But it has to be at a certain pH. Like at certain pH, is nitrogen can't be carried, right?
At certain pH, chem or organic, the plant has to have that pH to absorb it through its roots.
Yeah, and certain ones, like nitrogen's more available at certain pH. And
yeah, there's a range. There's like a chart. And that's kind of why people, they give you that range for cannabis.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, you get 5.5 or 5.8 or something.
Yeah.
There's going to be certain things that are more available than in the mid sixes and vice yeah. versa. Right.
You start out lower, end up higher, right?
Yeah. I mean,
if you want to do it that way.
So, you know, it's one of those things where like, if you have a well buffered organic soil, mm-hmm. it's probably something you don't have to think about.
Okay.
If, you know, but it also depends, like if you've got a great soil, but your water is pH 9 coming out because it's well water.
Yeah.
You might need to treat your water to not make the life of the microbial life in your soil harder.
Okay.
Right. But
yeah.
So there's an aspect to it where it's like, you know, and I don't think most people look at it as where it's like salts are sort of like a cheat code, you know, mm-hmm. where organics is like the pure way to go. Right. And I don't, well, I mean, there's an aspect to that. I do think it's true, but I also think that there's some organics that's dirtier than salt. You know, people think that like salt is made in some kind of crazy lab when really it's like mined minerals that are refined to a certain purity.
Uh-huh.
And when you're talking hydroponic purity, that's like one step below like pharmaceutical grade.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really clean and it's designed to run through aerojets, sprayers, drippers, all kinds of shit, not clog.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
You know, and all that. And so, you know, it's low in heavy metals, the good ones, you know, and that's another thing too, is like when people started, you know, and then you go organic, right? And so organic is a label, but I don't think most people get that a lot of the organic stuff that you get is byproducts from other industries.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
I don't think so, no.
If you get, I'll give you a perfect example, right? If you get bone meal or blood meal.
Yeah.
Okay. That's organic by law. But it comes from major slaughterhouses.
Well, that makes sense.
The cows aren't organic.
Yeah.
They weren't fed organic food. Okay. You could be getting McDonald's hamburger cows.
Yeah.
In your bone and blood meal. Burger King, okay. Wendy's, right? Think about yeah. like the biggest meat buyers and producers. And that's all mixed together and it's all the same. And there's not actually a way to differentiate unless you're really lucky and you know an organic farm.
Yeah.
But it's all certified organic. Right?
Is one better than the other though, like realistically?
Well, so bone meal is ground up bones from cows, right?
Okay.
Blood meal is the juice and the sluice that comes off the slaughterhouse floor.
Mm.
And they collect it and like yeah. powderize it. Delicious, right? Feather meal is the same shit. It's a byproduct from the poultry industry.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's feather meal. Sense.
Okay.
You know, turkey, chickens, you know, mm-hmm. All the parts that they can't sell you.
Yeah.
Ground up and turned into fertilizer.
Okay.
Right? So you have an aspect where it's like, oh, I'm fully organic. And then you end up like in the, I use bone meal and blood meal and feather meal and this and that. And you're like, holy fuck, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's legally organic. It's got the legal label.
Yeah.
By law, but it doesn't come from organic animals.
blood meal smells like girls' periods. It's gross.
Well, yeah, it is. And, you know, the issue used to become, too, where it's like, you know, when we used to be gorilla and stuff like that or whatever, when I first got to California, you use blood meal or something like that, and all of a sudden you get it wet, and the vultures smell it.
Yeah, my dog flips out.
And they start circling, or the dogs want to get into it, or a bear comes and wants to rip your shit up because it smells. You'd go put a bunch of awesome fish emulsion in your shit, and then you get a black bear.
Yeah, I
believe
it.
Who thinks that there's fish and starts digging for it.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're fucked, you know? And so there's an aspect where it's like people think there's a free lunch, and it's like it takes, even if you're using that stuff, it takes it a while for it to break down. Some of it's available quick, some of it not so much. And like fish emulsion and all that, that's all from the seafood industry.
Yeah.
It's all the brood bits of the nasty parts that they can't sell you. Yeah. Some people like build a soil or whatever, you know, like some people have stopped using bone meal because of the issues with cows and mad cow and just all the chem.
Yeah.
And they're selling you fish bone meal.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's still bones and still calcium and all that, but it comes from the seafood industry because it's not quite as toxic.
Yeah.
Even though it's organic. So you could have an organic style where you could pick all these inputs. Where I would rather use Canna or Cutting Edge.
Yeah.
I would think it would be cleaner to me.
Yeah.
You know, and even stuff that's clean, like bat guano or seabird guano, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where there's obviously not like factory bat guano or factory seabird.
Yeah.
But, you know, you are destroying habitat to get it.
Yeah.
Right? For bats, they're going into caves. And for seabirds, they're going to a lot of habitat and they're scraping the shit off it. Mm-hmm. Literally to send it to you.
Yeah.
And you know, do you know why that shit comes from like Indonesia and Peru and all that, not America?
I don't know. No.
Because America has OSHA and you can't send a 10-year-old boy with a bucket and a shovel into a cave.
That's a good point. I have watched him collect the guano.
I'm dead serious. Like that shit's fucked up. They do it where it's super cheap and there's not a bunch of labor law. And they'll do it industrial style, and they'll have a bunch of people with buckets, and they'll have like a bunch of bulldozers, and they'll be fucking up some huge. We have plenty of bats in America.
Yeah,
it's just cheaper to get it out of Peru or Indonesia and ship it because they don't have to obey labor laws.
Yeah, and kids are great workers. They're great.
Yeah,
workers.
You know, and there's not child labor in there. So a kid with a bucket, you know, and so it's good. Believe me, I've used tons of bat guano and seabird guano and stuff. So I'm not dissing it. I'm just saying that's the reality of getting it.
Yeah.
It's a great nutrient. I love plants from, I love brewing teas with it and stuff like that. It's like, it's good stuff, but it's not exactly harvested environmentally soundly. And what happens to the people isn't the greatest thing.
I remember the first time I got sent home with tea from the hydroponic store, my very first trip, got sent home with compost tea. And I really sat there wondering if I was supposed to drink this, like if it was some hippie brew, like that I was supposed to drink. I didn't understand it was for the plants. That's one of my embarrassing stories. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, back, you know, now we are really in a golden age of teas and composts and inputs and availability. I'll say that, like, I mean, I used to work in the hydro industry. And so I got to know how they sourced a bunch of amendments, what the differences in quality were and why certain companies were cleaner and better versus other ones that were using cheap inputs and covering it up.
Yeah.
Right. And now you have a situation that goes on, and it's really a bummer, but it's like there's a lot of stuff that's from the ocean that we used to consider super heady. Right. But now that they test for heavy metals, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Because it's got too much lead or too much arsenic or too much cadmium or whatever in it.
Yeah.
You know, so you could be like, oh, I'm using fish emulsion and this and that. And I've got all this amazing stuff. And I even have a hook. And you're putting all this stuff in there, and then your weed tests high for heavy metals.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they tell, like, women, you're only supposed to eat so much tuna and so much big fish when you're pregnant.
Oh, yeah, because the mercury.
Because the mercury. Well, that stuff is in, you know, you want to get some amazing crab or shrimp or whatever.
Yeah.
It's got it in it. Because they live in a bath of it, right?
Yeah.
And so in some cases, it's like people are like, oh, you know, salts are the evil bad choice.
Yeah.
And organics is the smooth, reliable choice. And I think that there's, you know, there's like, it's more complex than that.
Yeah.
And you can grow good weed with both. You know, there's a lot of organic weed that's grown that I don't consider that's that nice.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen some K&F shit be fucking wild.
Yeah, and so maybe we should, like, get out of the esoteric for a bit, and I'll tell a story that, like is pertinent to people smoking, right? So
I used to go
to the Oregon Country Fair, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which is right outside Eureka. It's like a famous hippie festival. It still goes on. Delayed a little bit with COVID or whatever. But so I went up there, and I was from Chicago, and I'd lived out in Cali for a few years and all that. But so I was all salt back then.
Mm-hmm.
Because where I grew up and where I came up, like, growing weed, you use salt. I lived mm-hmm. in apartments. Like, you weren't, like, grabbing soil. You didn't have a backyard, you know, like,
yeah.
It was like, so anyway, but you move out to Mendo and it's a lot more like back to the earth, back to the land or whatever. So there's a lot of people out here that grow dirt. And I went up there and I had all this salt weed. Okay. And it was mm-hmm. like the Super Skunk and the Chem 91 and the Mendo Perps and, you know, Sour Super Dog and stuff like that. And they all loved it. And they were all super prejudiced against chem weed.
Yeah.
But they loved my chem weed, right?
Yeah.
And then they all grew organic. And I never knew a bunch of cats that grew organic like that.
Yeah.
And so we were, like, comparing each other's weed all the time.
Yeah.
You know? And so we ended up teaching each other a bunch of shit.
Yeah.
Right? And I ended up going and working a little bit for John Jevons, who's written a couple famous books. He lives up in Willits by me, and learning as much as I could about organics, right?
Yeah.
At a time when, like, organics was very, very, like, do it yourself.
Yeah.
Not very many, online didn't exist really. Like, you know, it was basically you were buying raw amendments, and everything you had to do the work yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe there was earth juice.
Yeah.
Earth juice.
I remember Earth juice. Yeah.
Yeah. Still around. There was very few products. There was very few inoculants. There was very few bacteria. There was very few anything. It was like buy raw ingredients and go for it yourself. Right.
Yeah.
So I did this project for, I don't know, probably 4 years
mm-hmm.
where I grew my favorite strains in one of my rooms. And most of the room was dedicated for flower for medical. Right. But I had a section that side by side under the same two lights, I would grow the best organic weed I could, and I would grow the best salt weed I could of the same strains over and over and over again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just for head, and so I would pass out a bunch of joints to friends of mine and stuff like that, and it would all be blind testing, and they would just smoke and tell me what's up.
Yeah.
And that started to shock me, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes with certain strains, they consistently preferred the salt.
Yeah.
Right. And then the salt was so much easier. I didn't have to put all that. I mean, people should know back then, it's like we made our own soil in like concrete, in like those concrete tumblers, you know, you'd buy one of those,
you'd buy
your own concrete tumbler and you'd put all your amendments and you put everything in it and you'd stir it up and then you pour it out and you're wearing a mask. And I mean, I had multiple friends go to the hospital for fungus infections in their lungs.
I bet.
Breathing guano.
Yeah.
So it was actually kind of dangerous. Shit. You kind of had to like eye and mask and glove up to be, because you're working with a bunch of shit and a bunch of animal byproducts and all this different stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so I would try to make the headiest mix I could.
Yeah.
And I learned that like some strains, consistently people like the organic one better.
Mm-hmm.
And some strains, some consistently like the salt without
which
knowing
strains,
which was.
Do you remember? Do you remember
I
which
do,
strain?
Yeah, 100%. The chems and the sours mm-hmm. typically like were easier with salt.
Yeah.
The Mendo Perps, the Super Skunk, a few different ones would come out really nice organic.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not like it's not like they weren't good. It was just like what you preferred back to back. And I think that's really important for people. People have been asking me a bunch because I've been making some posts about various historical strains.
Yeah.
Really the only way to have like an effective comparison is for you to grow it yourself in your environment, in your room, same time. Okay, I'm going to get these four sour plants.
Yeah.
And I'm going to grow them at the same time under the same environment, right? I'm not going to get it from my buddy who grows a totally different style and his room's different temperature.
Yeah.
And I'm going to like, you just have to be able to see it in the same event, right? So
you need consistency.
All these plants, all these plants for 3-4 years were all treated the same way every time.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it was, and it, and so, you know, and I have a bunch of, obviously you have a bunch of friends that smoke weed. So you're giving out AB joints.
Yeah.
Right. And trying to get feedback. And I don't think most people ever compare styles. They're doing one style at a time.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you know what's different? Right. And so we were trying to figure out, like me and a few friends, we were trying to figure out, well, what is better?
Yeah.
What is, and it was surprising in the sense that, you know, and there's another aspect too, where it's like, you start to realize once you start to get a little bit more educated about it, but, indoor organic is almost never like outdoor organic.
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
So, well, I mean, I'll give you a perfect example to make total sense, right? So indoor organic is almost 100% organic, right? It's like a mixture of peat moss and perlite and, you know, or cocoa or different things, where outside maybe like 10% of the medium is organic.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is clay or crushed rocks. Minerals are like almost 45% of most soils. So like, that's why they talk about like, there's a 6-inch layer of topsoil in a lot of places. And that's like your organic matter. And then underneath that, it's a bunch of rock, basically. It might be porous rock, but crushed rock, but that's what most earth is. So like most people's organic inside is like soilless with added amendments.
Yeah.
Like you'd never find, like if you took say like Sunshine Number 4 or something and rice hulls and other shit and you add all your amendments and you make this super heady mix.
Yeah.
It wouldn't exist in nature anywhere. Your mix.
Yeah.
It's like a cannabis specific mix basically for an indoor garden.
Yeah.
So you never actually really like any kind of organic inside is like a series of compromises to begin with. Because you're not like scraping up a bunch of native earth.
Yeah.
And then using that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really organic, is it?
Well, I mean, you can't call it organic anyway. Organic is like a federal term.
So yeah, that's what I mean. It's like a,
I don't even think legal weed. I don't even think legal weed you're allowed to use the term organic yet.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't think so, because organic is actually, you have to meet federal criteria.
Yeah.
In order to get the organic label and not be lying, right?
Yeah.
But you can't get federal approval for cannabis because they still think it's funky.
Yeah.
You know, people are saying artificial light isn't organic. Right. So, you know, and then there's a thing too where people talk about, this is like a big keyword, and I'm by no means am I trying to diss anybody, but what does living soil mean?
Right. I always assumed it meant there were fucking worms and microbial life, a bunch of that shit.
Right, but almost all organic, if it's active, has a bunch of microbial life.
Sure.
You know, if you take home a well-made tea from your hydro store that they brewed fresh, or you make tea yourself, you're putting in trillions of living organisms into your soil. It's alive.
Yeah.
You know, it typically means when people talk about living soil, they're basically talking about usually like some kind of no-till method or some shit like that, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, but even that is like, do you know why most people use no-till?
I have no clue.
To prevent erosion, dude. There's a lot of, because if you don't till the earth, then when the rain comes, it's not going to wash away into the riverbank.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No.
No? Okay, so imagine like you're on a factory farm in fucking, you know, somewhere like Iowa.
Okay.
And you're tilling the earth like a foot deep. You're fluffing it up and you're making it all light and loose. And then there's torrential rain that comes in.
Okay.
And in that runoff, a bunch of earth washes away into the Mississippi.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right?
Okay.
So that's where most of our topsoil went. When they talk about the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, they tilled up all the earth and the wind came up and it blew all the fucking earth away. It did. There was like, there, because of the buffalo and shit, there was like 10 feet of topsoil in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what they were doing with farming, and they got a drought and they tilled it all up. And then all these huge winds came in and it washed it all fucking away. So
I had no idea that's what the Dust Bowl meant.
That's what the Dust Bowl was. It was literally people tilling farmland and then the farmland blowing away in the fucking storms.
So weird.
So no-till is basically like this thing where in conventional agriculture, they don't want to till the earth and have it blow mm-hmm. away or rinse away yeah. In rain. Yeah. So they don't till the earth. They leave it, right? And they just dig a hole for the plant. But mm-hmm. a lot of them use conventional herbicides and kill all the weeds.
Okay.
So no-till inside is like, this guy just commented, I thought no-till was like not disturbing the microbial content. Well, yeah. That's what weed people say. For yeah. for no-till outside, it's that, but it's also a huge amount of erosion control. But you don't have erosion problems indoors.
Yeah.
You could till all you want. It's not like you're going to get a windstorm that's going to blow away your shit, you know?
Yeah, that's why I was confused when you're talking about a windstorm. I'm wondering how that applies to indoor for no-till.
But that's what I mean. But like no-till was designed so the soil doesn't fly away.
Yeah.
And then it gets applied to an indoor environment where there's no wind.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's people, and when I'm talking about nutrition, I'm sure people are going to get all upset because you're going to start stepping on toes and they're going to say, oh, well, no, it's about the layers of microbial and fungal and this and that, not disturbing them or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But to be honest, like cannabis is a shallow root growth plant. It likes to grow wider than it goes deep.
Yeah.
And so basically what you're trying to do with cannabis is give it some kind of aerated, good amount of air and water and the ability for the roots to freely go where they want.
Yeah.
You know, so a hard, compact soil, that's not a good job.
I've also been accused of being wider than deep. This is
wider than deep. Yeah.
Times. Yeah.
Shallow even.
Shallow. Some say shallow.
Some would say shallow.
Yeah, wide is all in perspective.
Someone say, so getting back, to like what all this means is that, you know, I was reading some comments from some people the other day where they were talking about like their friends that do no-till, it works amazing for certain strains.
Yeah.
And then other strains they do don't respond very well to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you have a situation like we have a buddy up in Trinity and it's like, if you're going to do depths organically,
yeah,
that's a lot harder than a single season where you can give it, you know, food designed for vegetative growth for a series of months.
Yeah.
And then food designed for bloom for a series of months.
Yeah.
It's not as easy organically to like get two or three rips out of the same thing a year.
No. Yeah. That makes sense.
You know, and time it perfectly for what you're trying to do. So it's like, and I don't get me wrong. I think organic quality weed is like, can be better than any salt, to be mm-hmm. honest. But I think a lot of people don't get there. Like salt yeah. has a way higher floor. There's a lot of poorly yeah. grown organic weed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like they're messing up. It's more just like the availability of the food isn't there when the plant needs it.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, like that. Huh.
It took me years and years and years to finally smoke organic weed that was really grown well organic. And to me was as well grown as anything grown badass in salts. And that was from, Matt Elite. That dude kills it organic and changed a lot of my own ego with like thinking, oh, fuck, salts are so much better. So much easier. Why waste the time? Cause it was really special.
I mean, it also depends, you know, like, so, you know, you got to fit. And this is kind of like what I said in the beginning, where it's like, you know, you got to fit your growing style for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, of course.
Right. And that's important yeah. because they don't all fit, you know?
No.
And, you know, if let's face it, like in today's economy with the weed prices so cheap and, you know, no matter whether you're in the traditional market or you're in the fully legal market, you know, times are tough. Right. Yeah. And so people are trying to get X amount of weight per greenhouse or per outdoor patch or per grow room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to get as much pretty weed because people are visual as possible.
Yeah.
Right? And that's not necessarily heads. I mean, even back in the old traditional days, a lot of the guys I knew that were running 50 or 100 lighters would get their heads from people that were growing 6 or 8 lighters.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty common thing even now.
Yeah, well, the other part of it too is like back in the 215 days when anybody with a 215 card could go to a dispensary and, legally sell their herb to that dispensary,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Think about that dispensary. There was no regulations. There was no cost of entry. They bought so much garage weed.
Oh yeah, tons, dude.
And they could just pick based on quality.
Yeah.
And guys are bringing in weed that's like, you know, it was cut 2 weeks ago. It's fresh. It's still in the perfect form. It's in turkey bags. It's like not very regulated. And they could just pick the best and ditch the rest.
Yeah.
Now with all this legality, you know, a lot of times some of that weed doesn't hit the shelf for 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's being grown in these big salt factories, or it's being grown at a scale where like all the little things that the eight lighter guy could do, they can't. So weed sucks. Huh?
You've actually experienced scaling up major, right?
Oh yeah.
Why don't you talk about that? I've never done except for the big reversal and having to save those dummies fucking already flowering crop for a reversal. I had never done major scale as far as feeding and all that stuff. And it was significantly different, especially re-vegging at that scale. It was insane.
And there's an aspect too where you can talk about, this is pretty funny because, you know, there was these people that just opened up like whatever it is, like 126 acres in fucking SoCal, and they're calling it craft, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody agrees that there's a difference between craft and commercial.
Yeah.
The difference is that people get hyphy about like, where is that line?
Yeah.
You know, and like I said before, I used to never see the people that were great growers and doing a great job. They still would not get the same quality weed out of their 50 or 100 lighter that we would get out of a garage size scene.
Yeah.
For the most part, they just wouldn't. They had way less time per plant. They weren't doing quite as many little things that made the plants happy. You know, like it was a little bit more commercial. And, you know, and then there's an aspect too, where it's like so scaling becomes hard. And a lot of times when people scale, they lose quality. So we could talk about that for a minute too. And I'm not trying to diss them, but you look at like the Jungle Boys, right? Mm-hmm. Or some of these big, you know, Rockwool factory farms.
Yeah.
They're doing that because they have all these different rooms, mm-hmm. and relying on a bunch of hippies and weirdos to like hand water everything right every day is problematic.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, they're trying to automate all this different shit. And then just like work on looking at the data and then messing with the settings and the data and not looking each individual plant, right?
Yeah.
And so what they're doing is that there's a lot of technology from Northern Europe that basically is the basis of all hydroponics.
Yeah.
Grodan, all that. They all learned how to do mm-hmm. all this growing tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers and all these vegetables for places that are shitty like Northern Europe but have money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can go there and you can see hothouses, greenhouses that have tens of thousands of plants, tens of thousands of lights. Huge. Yep. Right? So you see these trick systems that they're installing, they're all based on that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you get all these things and they're looking at graphs, right? And they've got like the moisture meter and they're perfectly planning the wet and dry cycles and they're you know, dialing in their salts and everything. And it's like, even the setup itself is like a plumbing nightmare. Mm-hmm. It's so intense. And then people call their weed cardboard.
Yeah.
Right. Because what happens is you're trying to do a one size fits all, and cannabis actually, it turns out, it doesn't like being fed perfectly its whole life.
No.
Like, they've done studies where they've shown that certain amounts of drought stress or certain amounts of stress to the plant actually creates more terpenes and more crystal.
Yeah.
I'm not saying beat the hell out of your plant.
No, I've seen it firsthand, though. Stress, like, where did I first learn that about it? It had to do with bugs attacking the plant, and that's why the trichomes are there.
Yeah, bugs. Bugs signal, they signal a thing to the plant where I need to make more THC. I need to make it harder for them to crawl on me. I need to make it harder for them to bite me, you know? And so you get these perfect rooms and everything's perfect and everything's dialed in and they're like fine tuning stuff and they have control over all their parameters, right? And then their weed comes out, not that good, you know? And the guy that they got a little dry and a little wilty a few times and they stressed here and there a little bit, like that weed was happier.
Yeah.
It was better, but they're trying to grow like a reasonably good looking product at scale.
Yeah.
And they can't have fucking, you know, 3 dozen rooms and treat it like you have a garage or treat it like you have one greenhouse and no job.
Yeah.
You know, you know, you have a situation, there's people that you, that are on IG that are quite popular and they don't have that many plants and they have a greenhouse.
Yeah.
And that's their job. And you can go out there and you can baby them and you can give them every little thing. But then you join a legal scene and like you're working, I don't talk very much about what I was doing, but like you try to develop some things at scale and you've got to water some acreage and it's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And it's not that easy to do.
No, I can't imagine.
You know,
really, and so there's so much to go wrong.
A lot of people messed up even just going from how big they were doing just to like two or three or four 10,000 square foots.
Yeah.
Like, and they started really, and they started, you know, really messing, you know, they started really messing up.
Yeah.
You know, and so like a lot of, and that's why, because like dispensaries can't just buy the best weed from whoever walks in with a duffel bag anymore.
Yeah.
They were able to buy from like a lot of small time local gardeners, you know, and the Bay would get tons of people from even LA, LA and San Diego were flooded with weed from Humboldt and Lake.
Oh, yeah.
Mendo.
Yeah,
like there was people that would drive up to my area every week to get weed to bring it down to the dispensaries. That was their entire gig, was to flow it right into dispensaries. And so they could say yes or no to any weed that walked through their door. Right. And now there's all this regulation and there's all this thing and there's all this packaging and there's all this testing and there's all this time and people are trying to learn how to grow on a lot bigger scale. And their weed is like, way down in quality, in my opinion, you know, and people are going to learn, they're going to get better over time. But right now customers are fucked because they're paying more than they used to. And the availability is shittier.
But at least it looks good on IG.
It looks, and that's another thing. IG fucked it all up.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't sniff it or smell it or anything like that. Like you know, you could just see it. And so cookies was perfectly timed for the social media wave.
Yeah.
Because it was unusually visually attractive.
And very unique looking. It definitely did stand out from what was out there.
Yeah, and now there's a whole thing where you see so many of these different strains, and a lot of them, I think, have been chosen based on looks and testing.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be like, not to judge it, but, oh, look, here's apple fritter, and it tested 33%, and look how fire it looks.
And then it fucking is the worst herb balm on the face of the earth for breeding.
Or you smoke it, and everyone's all excited because the people that they respect are hyping it, and then 6 months later, you know, you're like, I don't think I'm going to buy that $70 eighth.
Yeah.
It just didn't hit it for me.
You know what? Before we scoot too far along, I do remember there's one thing that I wanted to talk about. And when it's feeding for breeding, as far as vegetative stuff, one thing that I find a lot of breeders do when I talk to them, and it's totally counterproductive, is when you are running cycles of different rooms and different strains, you're trying to do multiple projects and they're one after the other, after the other. You start learning to feed differently to slow down the growth, to try to make room. And that's not something that's totally counterproductive and counterintuitive. But some of us have learned how to stunt our plants and bring them out of being stunted, because it's just, there's no way to constantly have that room to feed in new cycles. So, you know, there's things you'll do when breeding that you would never do for production, because it would absolutely just butt fuck you for great flower.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you've got a big collection of moms and stock, then very likely what you're doing is you're keeping a bunch at moderate to small size under enough light to like keep them going and happy, but nothing too vigorous. And then you've got
moderate health.
And then you're planning on putting some plants in like a vigorous, very well lit spot to get them going, because you have projects in mind for them and you want to get very vigorous cuttings and small plants going off them. And so there's a rotation there that goes in where it's like
a fine balance.
Yeah.
If you're hurting to not, you know,
if you're someone like Kale, you know, like CSI or whatever, and you've got 150 different plants in moms, and then you've got a bunch of stuff you're keeping for pheno hunting, and all of a sudden you've got hundreds of different strains, and you might want to slow things down on a bunch of it.
Yeah.
A pheno hunt, you might want to keep it going really slow.
Yeah.
You know, and even starve it somewhat. Until you see what you have. Because if you start pumping it, like you're trying to pump it to get ready to bloom a room, all of a sudden you've got jungle growth, and where do you put it all?
Yep. Especially keeping some of the older lines, the NL5 hazes and stuff like that. It gets jungly so fucking fast.
Yeah, it gets jungly, you know? And then, you know, and so you have an aspect where it's like, I just thought we could talk about it from a flower perspective too, because you try to talk to people, and like the thing that I get the most when you try to talk nutrition is like smugness. Like people are smug.
Oh, yeah.
Like they want to know that I'm growing the better way. Mm-hmm. This way works. You know, what the fuck are you talking about? I get 2.5 pounds of light. Everybody thinks my weed is fire, you know? And I'm not dissing anybody. I'm not like, that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say that like very few people are doing side by sides to try to see what methods are giving them better weed. Yeah. They're growing the same style at one time. And if they change styles, they change it over entirely.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're not really comparing. You're just, and you know, most people's goals are just to sell it. Right. So there's things with organic. Like when I first moved here, there was people that had been using their beds or using their holes in the hills or whatever for 10 or 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And every year those things got better and better. Right. Because they were able to add amendments. They were able to add, you know, bacteria and various things. It was alive. It was like old and aged and fully functional and work and going good to go. If you're going to grow organic, the first rip or two probably isn't going to be as nice as the fifth or sixth one.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because you've heard about green sand.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard about green sand? Green sand doesn't even become bioavailable for 2 years after you put it in.
Yeah. Same with normal silica. You know, it's like 1 year, I think.
There's things that are on that are fairly immediate. There's things that take 2 or 3 months. There's things that take a year, you know? And so if you have aged stuff, you know, like a lot of that breaking down and availability has happened. And the natural cycle is doing it for you. But if you're starting a fresh facility, you're going to get a bunch of raw ingredients or whatever, like, you know, tossed together, and you're going to have to amend.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you're like, if you probably another thing is that like, if you're a small tent farmer or you're a small garage farmer and you're just trying to grow the best you can, don't try to copy some giant scene.
Yeah.
They are not the way for you. They are not growing as good a weed as you could on a smaller scale. You're like a hobbyist slash farmer. Right?
Yeah.
If you're going to grow at scale, you're going to try to have to figure out how can I take the methods that I like and scale them up.
Yeah.
You're probably going to sacrifice some quality at scale, you know? And, you know, and if you're trying to grow for seed, then, you know, then definitely you're not growing for flower. You're probably going to want to add more nitrogen. You're probably going to want to top dress with some different things, you know?
I also like to use I'm a sucker for Power SI, just because I used, you know, regular silica for so long and didn't understand that it wasn't really very bioavailable for the plant. And when I started using the Power SI stuff, because someone was asking about feeding for veg moms and stuff like that, that's probably been one of the biggest game changers for me, was that specific additive, monosilicic acid or orthosilicic acid, because it makes everything so readily and bioavailable. It's just so fast how quick it uptakes nitrogen and everything that goes along with it.
And I should also say something too, right? Like, so whether you're organic or salt, one of the big reasons why things don't grow in winter is that the roots get too cold.
Yeah.
And then the pores shrink. And when the pores shrink and the relationship between the pressure within the roots and within the soil itself changes, they can't uptake salt. So if you're feeding with 50 degree water and you've got, and you're growing with like Canna or, you know, or Athena or any of these things people are mentioning, and it's too cold, your plants are all going to suffer. Because the plant's not going to suck up the nutrition. Your pH can be perfect, right?
But the temperature's too much for it.
It needs a certain temperature range.
Yeah.
And there's also a thing, too, where it's like water in the 80s holds like half the oxygen that water in the 60s holds. So there's actually like a window there.
Yeah.
Where like mid-60s to low 70s is probably the best ratio of like absorbability versus like oxygen ratio, because the only place your plant really absorbs oxygen is through its roots.
Yeah.
It takes CO2 in through the leaves and it takes O2 in through the roots, you know? And when people overwater, that's what fucks the plant up, is there's no oxygen in there. The roots can't breathe, so they drown. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, you know, there's an aspect where it's like, if you're growing indoor and you want to be organic, there's trade-offs. Like, you see these people that are like, I'm on the 26th cycle. You know, I just add various amendments over time. I just water it. The organic does what it needs to do. The plant absorbs what it wants when it wants. But then I have people that grow organic, that grow in pots, and their whole goal is to give it enough food to veg and bloom to where they want, and then run out of food towards the end, so that the plant starts to starve itself for nutrition and you start getting all those beautiful autumn colors on the plant.
Yeah.
And then when you harvest it, it's used up all of its excess, because if you're growing K&F style, or you're growing like stuff that's amended that you just, you know, you're no till and you're never changing it, well, then you're never flushing, for instance.
Yeah.
And so some people are a big believer in flush, you know, whether you're even salt or organic. Some people want to give it just the amount of food it needs and then starve it.
Yeah.
And some people give it chock full food right up until the end of flower.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you're growing for production, you know, like people, the other thing is like when you're growing for flower, and this always used to make me laugh, right? Is that people want the best weed, but one yellow leaf and you fucked up. You know, they're looking at a bag and they're like, oh, there's a tiny bit of brown in there.
Yeah.
There's a tiny little bit of yellow. You should give me a deal.
Yeah.
This is some fucked up weed. And you're like, no, I flushed it for 2 weeks. It's perfect.
Yeah, right? That's supposed to look.
And they're like, no, it's got some funk in it. So a lot of people will just pump it right up until the day of harvest.
Because it looks better.
Because it looks better to the broker. It's not going to smoke as good.
Yeah.
But it looks better to the broker.
Yeah.
And that's what they care about. They don't want the broker to bitch and start kicking the tires and try to knock points off.
Yeah.
Right? And so then people don't grow as nice a weed. I mean, there's even a thing where, like, you know, I'll say this about the chems, where it's like, if you grow the dog, or what people call the chem 91 now, and you take it what we all used to take it, which is about 70-ish days, it usually tests between 18 and 22%.
Yeah.
And it knocks your head off, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you take it 53 or 54 days, it'll still have white hairs all over it, but it'll test 28 to 32%.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people that like put it on the market, they take it early, right?
To get that high percentage.
Because the shop and the distro or whatever, like it's one, they don't want to give you for a 19 or 21% weed. They don't want to give you the price point.
That's so fucking
insane. But if it's 31%, so you'll see weed and you're like, I'll look at this weed and I'll be like, that dog is like 2 weeks preemie.
Yeah.
But it tests at 30%. And the shop is happy.
Yeah.
And the distro is happy and they'll give you your price.
Yeah.
And it's not as good for the smoker. Right. But a lot of cases, like these regulations and these new rules are not taking the smoker into account.
I mean, it, in some sense, though, like I think smokers may have priced themselves out just by absorbing things like cookies, things that are, you know, cardboardy with high THC stuff, and they were happy with it. Despite most people, like when you really ask them, like, do you really like that, you know, the form cut? Do you really like getting high off that? Like, they'll be like, oh, it's okay, you know, for 20 minutes or 10 minutes, and then it's, you know, whatever. But
yeah,
they kind of let themselves be told what to buy, you know?
They do.
And this is where we ended up.
So there's an aspect, one of the things that's interesting, and it's something I mentioned before, but it bears repeating, I guess, is like the first 4 or 5 years that they published like the Emerald Cup and like some High Times entries for THC.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to see, like, you know, before people were breeding by numbers, before a lot of breeders were getting data on like what the THC content was, almost everything that was winning was between 22 and 26%.
Yeah.
There was like 4 or 5 things in the first 5 years, like that ever tested in the upper 20s or hit 30.
Yeah.
Right. And 2 of them were Chem 91. There was a strawberry cough. There was another weird one. You remember how rare the 30% club used to be?
Yeah. Yeah. It was unheard of until like 2009, 2010, people started claiming the 30s.
30%, right? And so yeah. Now you have this, so basically all the favorite weed that people were paying good digits for was mm-hmm. coming in the low to mid 20s at best.
Yeah.
So it basically means as soon as you hit high teens to mid 20s, that's where almost all the elites were falling.
Yeah.
Everything that everybody fucking drools over from back then, Kushes, mm-hmm. Sours, fucking all this shit was all hitting that range.
Yeah.
And then people started growing because shops were like, I'll pay you more for higher THC.
Yeah.
So they start selecting cuts that test better.
Yeah.
Not necessarily ones that smoke better.
And start selecting labs that test higher.
So now that's why I say breeding by numbers.
Yeah.
Breeding so you're instead numbers. Of breeding by smoke testing and what your friends think and how long lasting the high is, like you were mentioning, or how intense it might be. They start being like, oh, well, this one tests at 32 and 4% terpenes.
There is no such thing as a fucking high 30 yet, is there?
I mean,
are we at the high 30s now?
So, I mean, there's a lot of things that people do. Like, CSI have talked about this a bunch, where there's a lot of labs that overtest.
Sure.
Because it's good for the distro. It's good for the store. It makes an easy sale. Everybody likes it. And so he's done experiments where he's sent things off to commercial labs and sent the same bud to a friend who he knows is going to do an accurate test. Mm-hmm. And it might be as much as 5 or 8% different.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it much different, vastly different. It's insane.
But the thing is now you've got 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, 10 years or whatever, breeding by numbers. And there's a huge 30%+ club.
Oh, good. Good. Skunkmaster Flex posted something that's 40%. Well, there we go.
So you start getting higher and higher, right? But then the effect sucks.
Yeah.
So then what does it matter?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I had a blueberry purple punch test at 34. So, you know, anything's possible. You can't even pull those numbers out of them individually, you know?
And what's crazy about that is when you think about 30 or 35 or 40, like Matt was just laughing about, that's the percentage of THC by weight on the flower.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
It's crazy because you start getting to these numbers and it's like, is it just going to be like, you know, how much THC can you pack on a plant?
Yeah. And how much is left for cannabinoids and other cannabinoids? And yeah.
And it's not obviously like alcohol where Everclear is stronger than vodka, which is stronger than wine, which is stronger than beer. It doesn't work like that. Yeah. Like there is a certain situation where like, you know, CSI and I see Fletch on there. There's some old school strains that only test like 8, 10, 12%.
Yeah.
And they don't hit that hard. But once you get up to 18 to 20 to 22 to 24, that's where like all the elites and the old best weed falls.
You know where most of the skunky stuff is falling right now that we've been looking at?
Low teens.
No. 4 to 8. 4 to 8 for the most skunky stuff.
I mean, you know, the Mendo Perps is supposedly, you know, seed from the late 70s or whatever.
Yeah.
And it tests, you know, 8 or 10% at best.
Yeah.
Some of the S1s can get up into the high teens. Yeah. But the mom cut itself is pretty low, you know? Yeah. And I think that used to be super common. Like, I think even like old school Skunk 1, right?
Yeah.
Was 13 to 15 back then.
Yeah.
When they could get testing done.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so we've gone from like the start of everything where things were, you know, low to, you know, high single digits to low teens to mid teens to upper teens, low 20s.
Yeah.
And now it's all, maybe it's all fake or whatever, but it doesn't seem like after a certain point, there's a big correlation between high numbers and best effect.
No, not at all.
Because my friend would get all pissed off because they'd be like, dude, I don't know if I can get your weed for the right price. This Chem 91 is only testing at 18%.
Mm-hmm.
But it took your head off.
Yeah.
You know, but they would rather take 2 week preemie Chem 91 because it tests at 29.
Yeah.
Right. And so I just think that like people started rather, the only thing that matters is like how it affects you. And
yes.
The more people get away with effects and like not testing stuff, like by smoking it with a variety of humans.
Yeah.
Because even one person, two people, like some of my favorite weed is stuff that Matt doesn't like at all.
Yes.
just not that he doesn't appreciate it. It just doesn't make him feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of it just fucks me up, like paranoid or anxiety or yeah.
Yeah. Some people get weirded out. Some people love a buzz. Some people like sativa. I mean, there's a range of effect.
Yeah.
And so I think if you get away from, like, I don't think a bunch of people are doing smoke testing anymore.
Yeah.
They're trying to find something that looks impressive and tests impressive.
Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden now we have a bunch of like midzy elites.
Yeah.
Right. We have a bunch of elites where it's like people were saying, oh, I hate fritter, you know, like, well, there was a minute there where like, and people are growing stuff because they're like, oh, this weed gets this amount of pound.
Yeah.
It's an elite. So I'm going to grow lemon cherry gelato, or I'm going to grow this runts by this, or I'm going to grow this jealousy cut because my buddies can get top dollar for it. And I'm not trying to call it mids, but it's probably not going to stand the test of time.
No.
You know, like right now, sour's coming back around. Diesels.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's fire weed. And it works and it smokes and it tastes great.
Yeah.
You know, and that weed that works is always going to have a popularity basis.
Yeah.
Where weed that doesn't work, you know, like you can only, the hype boys can only hype it for so long. I mean, Burner can obviously sell the shit out of anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's great at promotion. He's great at getting hip hop and rap and various stars smoking his weed and exclusive spots and building up.
But hype. He's a horrible, horrible kisser.
Don't let him lie to you.
He's a liar about that shit.
But there's an aspect where it's like you can only promote something for, you can only force people to like something for so long.
Yeah.
Before they make their own decision.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's why you have all this shit that like gets like flash in the pan that gets popular for 8 or 10 months or a year and a half.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. It's replaced by some new hype.
Yep.
Where things that used to get popular before, like the purples or the Kushes or the sours or whatever, or the Skittles, when they become organically popular, right? Where it's like grassroots popularity drives it. They're a lot more lasting.
Yeah.
Than when it's hyped. You know,
yeah.
Because hype has become marketing. Cannabis weed wasn't ready for modern marketing, dude.
No,
we weren't ready for it at all. We were so ripe to be abused by modern advertising techniques.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it just got overwhelmed and people realized, oh, I don't even need to have good weed to make money.
10 years ago, that shit wouldn't have worked. Everybody would have laughed at a motherfucker for trying to front that hard. You know, but nowadays it just flies.
10 years ago, the only way something became elite was when enough people that were respected decided it was good.
Yeah.
And like, or, and you know, the market demanded it.
Yeah.
And the market, really, when it boils down to it, when you have stuff like the Purple Wave with the Urkel and the Mendo P and the Grape Ape and all those and Granddaddy and all that, or you have the Kush Wave in Southern California or the Sour thing that happened for 10 years, that was market dictated. A bunch of people wanted to get as much of it as they could.
Yeah,
because they knew that the customers would endlessly buy it and they didn't get burned out.
Yeah.
That's why you can have 40 different fucking named Kushes in SoCal.
Yeah.
I was trying to name them all the other day and it like made me want to pound my head against the, because literally like you could walk into, and you know, 2010, you could walk into a dispensary in LA and they would literally have like 24 kinds of Kush.
Oh, easily. Some of them had like 50, 60 different types of OGs. Yeah.
Yeah. All these different names. And some of them were repeated and just somebody.
Oh, of course. Like, yeah. But they just had different names. Yeah.
But yeah, like the entire dispensary was one family of weed and slight variations.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, from the East Coast and different things coming to California, sour was like endless.
Yeah.
There was endless demand for gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now instead of seeing endless demand for one or two things that people can focus on, a lot of growers are like, what the fuck do I even grow?
Yeah.
Because if you're in the legal market, you don't have a direct connection with your consumer. You have to get a distro and unless you own them, you have to get a distro and then a dispensary to buy it.
I remember Red up in Canada talking about that with the Canadian legal stuff. About now they have the buyers are people that aren't even from cannabis now. And they are who determine what value you're getting for your weed. Non-smoking.
Oh, yeah.
Corporate people.
Honestly, that was a depressing part of that. I really liked that interview. He was super personable.
Yeah.
That was hard to listen to. just the reality of what matters and what doesn't.
Yeah.
And him looking at testing and paperwork and deciding what to do without even seeing the wheat, because if it didn't have the testing and the paperwork right, it was irrelevant.
Yeah, it just didn't matter.
And so a lot of times, okay, there's a lot of stuff out there that's really fire weed, and the reason why you can't get it is because it doesn't make financial sense for the grower to grow it, because the people that are in between him and you don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So you get fucked.
Yeah.
You personally out there, you get fucked. Because the grower's friends get to have it sometimes. You know, it gets traded amongst each other. It gets survived and all that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the consumer doesn't get to see it.
Yeah.
You know, and we were joking, I'll mention it one more time, because there's this, you know, huge grow that's getting set up in SoCal. It's like over 100 acres, and everybody was ragging on them or whatever, because it's like another big corporate takeover type thing, right?
Yeah.
And you look at their clone list, and they're getting a bunch of Gelato hybrids and Skittles hybrids, right? Like, the market is underserved right now with Gelato and Skittles.
Yeah.
They really got to fill that niche.
Yeah.
Of course not, you know? And so, and you know, if customers could buy straight from the farm or straight from cooperatives or whatever, you know, then cooperatives would be able to grow more niche weed, you know, and be like, oh, I'll do some, try to get some real Bubba Kush.
Yeah.
Try to find some real Sour Diesel. Try to find some Urkel. Try to find, you know, there should be, with legality, all the classics. You should be able to buy Led Zeppelin in the record store.
Oh, I was like, what? They got a straight Led Zeppelin?
I just mean, imagine, like, you're like, oh no, it's not popular anymore. You weren't around the 70s. You can't buy it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like, legal weed, there should be a thing where it's like all the hits, if we're going to compare it to music, right? You can go get all kinds of punk that's like way out of date.
Yeah.
But you can't get Acapulco Gold.
Yeah.
You can't get Urkel. You can't get, you know, G13 NL2. You can't get the classics of weed, right? And so right now, California itself is awash in all this candy name bullshit, right? Yeah. Which is fine. If people want to buy that stuff, it's fine. I'm not trying to throw it out there. But you can't, you know, like, you know, it can't all be Sherbalato.
It is, though.
It is. Why can't I get real Sour Diesel? Why can't I get real Kush? Why can't I get Trinity? Why can't I get Bubba Kush?
Yeah.
Why can't I get Granddaddy Purple?
Yeah.
You know, because there's like, you know, consumers don't have power to demand. They have to go to the store and they have to buy what the store wants to put in their store.
Yeah.
You know, and that might be getting chosen based on their margin. There's this company up by me, fucking Flocana, right? They blew through a shit ton of money. Do you know, I don't know if people know this, but like, there's a lot of big companies that pay dispensaries for shelf space.
Yeah.
Straight shelf space. Like, you know, and that's a profit they make just to put the weed on the shelf so the consumer can see it. You know, in the 50s or in the 60s or whatever, there was that huge record scandal because all the DJs, disc jockeys, it was pay to play.
Oh yeah, the payola.
Yeah. So how does your hit be popular if you can't get a radio station to play it so people hear it and they want to go buy your album?
Yeah.
And there's people that were getting bribed to play certain things and not play others.
Yep.
I'm connecting it to music again, but it's the same fucking thing. These dispensaries, because there's not enough of them, they're deciding what gets on their shelf and not, and they're deciding it what's based on what's good for them.
Yeah.
Not what's good for the consumer out there, what's good for them.
Yeah.
You know, so choice has actually gone down.
Quite a bit.
Quite a bit. Expense is up, quality is down, choice is down. And how do you, like, let's say that you know, CSI or somebody like, or me or whoever, Fletch, comes up with an amazing new hybrid.
Yeah.
Right? Unless you're vertically integrated and you can control the supply chain, you can't even guarantee you're going to get it in a shop.
Oh, yeah.
You can't guarantee at all that a bud tender will give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like a whole deluge of like everything that's already popular and variations on that theme, you know, and it gets controlled. And so the reason why I think that all these elites I always talk about, like, the 90s and the early 2000s are still my favorite era of weed, is it's because the best weed from then was consumer choice.
Sorry, I just read that question popped up after everything we said. Anyway,
but you know, but yeah, that, you know, it all the, you know, sour became popular, Kush became popular because people wanted it. They were willing to spend a bunch of money on it. There was demand, and you know, and people wanted to fill that demand.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's, here's a bunch of weed. And with nurseries, people might not know this, but most like cultivators, they don't even get to keep their own mom house. They have to get it from a nursery.
That's so wild.
And then the nursery might offer 10 or 15 different things for this season. They might have 100 things, but they only mommed up enough to do like a lot of certain stuff.
Yeah.
So then you're forced to operate off their menu. So it's like the nursery limits you, right? Like when I was working at a big scene a couple of years ago, I was trying to find some real sour diesel, like on the legal market metric.
You know? Yeah.
And I couldn't find it pure.
Of course.
The best thing I could find was Spyrock Sour, which was some sour across to some Kush. Yeah. I couldn't find it pure to grow on the farm I was consulting at.
Yeah.
You know? But back in the day, in 2015, you could be like, oh, we're going to fill these four greenhouses with this.
Yeah.
And then we're going to take duffel bags to the dispensary. And then you're going to buy it. And people are going to be stoked.
64 ruined the fucking world, I'm telling
most
you.
Most of the good Kush, a lot of the good Kush that was in LA came from my neck of the woods.
Yeah.
There was constantly brokers coming up that their entire job was just to grab excess capacity from up here and bring it down to the SoCal, you know, dispensaries.
Yeah.
You know, and so people could go hunt the best weed and then go, and then the dispensaries could pick the best weed if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Now it's like they have to buy it from they have to buy it from a distro, and the distro has to buy it from a farmer, and it just turned everything into like a commodity.
Yeah.
You know, and so as a result of that, I was worried about a bunch of shit with legalization. I never thought that like we would accept way higher prices than the black market or the gray market and shittier quality.
Yeah.
But so far that's what we've gotten.
Yep. Sure is.
You know, that's what we've gotten. And so, you know, we started off talking about, and the reason why we've gotten that is because you have all these commercial farms that have intense pressure with taxes and overhead and regulations and paying out all this fucking money, right? And quality and consumer happiness is like, they do the best they can in some instances, but it's not that great. But they're doing the best they can with the constraints they're put under.
Yeah.
And a lot of little things that used to get done to make weed nice is getting eliminated.
Yeah.
And so your weed isn't as nice. You know, and people talk about all the time, your weed is fire. Your weed's not fire.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times too, it's like some of these things like the Emerald Cup and all this different shit, you know, like, and I'm not saying this, I've known Tim for a long time, so this isn't a diss at him on any level, but when you're forced to basically, like, for the most part, only accept from, like, licensed buyers, people aren't entering the best weed in California anymore.
No, no.
Because you have to cut off this large segment of the population that used to win fucking cups.
Yeah.
That used to be able to come there with their perfectly grown greenhouse weed from their little greenhouse that they treated perfect, and they got to give 2 to 4 ounces to the testing. And then they placed third.
Yeah.
Oh. But, you know, but the thing is, the difference, Fletcher's like, stop shitting on my weed. The difference between Fletcher from what I understand is that they have a dispensary.
Yes.
They have control. Archive can make a choice to, I'm like, I'm going to take the Moonbow. I'm going to take this that I love, and I'm going to make sure consumers get it.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. but most farmers in California aren't vertically integrated.
Yeah.
No, they have to sell their wheat. They have to sell their wheat, you know? And so if you're vertically integrated, then you can have some uniqueness and you can choose, like, he could choose to take things that he doesn't want to share, and you can only come to his stores to get them.
It's no fair, motherfucker.
You know, and a lot of people are cut off, and a lot of people's top shelf, a lot of dispensaries' top shelf used to be 6 to 20 lighters.
Yeah.
You know, done by small scale people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was constantly filling the top shelf because that was the top shelf.
Yep.
Now all those people are fucking cut off. And what used to be the midzy shelf is now top shelf for more money.
Well, those people are looking for new fucking jobs. Kind
of
sucks.
Yeah, you know, and so a lot of the best weed got cut off from consumers.
Yeah.
You know, before they could even smoke it. You know, you can't, like, I don't know, you can't get real haze in California.
Yeah. No.
You can't get real sour diesel. It's starting to make a comeback. Maybe it'll start forcing itself on some shelves.
Yeah.
But there's only, but then there's all this stuff too, where it's like these vertically integrated companies, like if you're going to get from Jungle Boys or whoever, you're probably going to get mostly their weed that they're growing because they want to sell their weed through their outlet.
Yeah.
Too. So then, you know, you get the selection from them, you know, and a lot of these dispensaries have captured markets. So what you're getting is you're getting a lot of commercially grown weed that they're trying to grow for cheap and get a minimum level of quality. And then you're trapped because you can only, there's only, you know, 700 stores in California. And you got to buy it from one of them and you can't really get great deals. So you end up like getting a bunch of expensive commercial.
Yeah.
And that access to that actual top shelf, that actual fire that was treated deliciously and grown perfectly with organic or salt or whatever, and all the little things done the right way.
Yeah.
You don't even get to see that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what's funny is all these American beer companies were never winning any beer awards. Did you know that? Right.
No.
So all these like international competitions, obviously like Michelob and Milwaukee's Best and Budweiser and all that were never winning any gold medals at any of these competitions.
The Beast wasn't winning medals?
No. So they made their own category, American Lager.
Oh, yeah.
So now a bunch of these companies have gold medals because they were only fucking competing against themselves.
Yeah.
Right? When they were competing against other microbreweries and places from Belgium and Germany and all that shit, they had no chance.
Yeah.
Their beer wasn't as good.
Yeah.
Right? So now you're getting the same thing here where you're getting all these big factory farms and they're like, do you want Old Style? Do you want Old Milwaukee? Do you want Michelob? Do you want Budweiser? Do you want Coors?
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you want some Hetty? How about some Heineken?
Yeah.
Maybe some Amstel Light, get an import, right? And that's what you're competing against. You actually can't get these little things where the quality really matters. Yeah. And until they open that stuff up. So if you're growing for yourself, I said it before, don't emulate some big farm.
Yeah.
They're cutting corners. They're doing things that only work at scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And all that, right? Like do things. I don't want to get too technical because I'm trying to keep it general enough that like, you know, it stays fairly popular because I don't know how many people are actual growers on this thing versus just smokers or whatever. But, it's there's an aspect where it's like plants don't drink the same. It's really hard to like just automate everything.
And there is microclimates even. Like we learned this in reversing a shitload, how one clone to the next clone won't reverse the same way, even if they're 2 feet apart from each other or a foot apart from each other, getting the same exact feed. Microclimates are a real thing too. So
microclimates and some of those big rooms, the microclimates are really different.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, we haven't even talked about spectrum, but that has a big, if you're not growing with the sun, one of the best lights to this day is still the single ended old school Hortilux 1000.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these grown under double endeds and stuff like that, like a lot of them, people are choosing spectrums that give the most weight and not blends that give a better quality. You know, and because we're not in a position yet, it's like such a regulated and taxed industry that the best isn't allowed to bubble to the top. It's controlled by dispensaries, by dispos, by burner, by people popularizing things, by celebrities stepping in and people throwing their money around. And so that's why if you're bummed at how the weed sucks in clubs, that's why.
Yeah.
Because consumer choice has gone way down since 2015.
We are at an hour and a half right now.
Dang.
People, if you want to start winding it down, we could start doing the shit. You want to take some questions or?
I could take some questions. I mean, I could talk too. Maybe I'll talk for 5 or 10 minutes, even though we're winding it down, because I haven't talked about it. But aside from nutrition and environment, which we kind of talked about a little bit before, the spectrum that the plants grow under makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And that could probably be its own whole show. But just in general, plants developed underneath the sun, which has all the spectrum all the time. Everything from UV to, you know, every color, huge. Where most indoor lights are approximations of that, and they have relatively narrow spectrums.
Yeah.
Right? And you put plants underneath them, and they grow vastly differently depending on what kind of light they're exposed to.
Yeah.
We used to, 20 years ago, when there wasn't all these other lights, we would grow one light of metal halide. And the buds would come out half the size, but they would burn better and they'd be way frostier than the HPS stuff.
Yeah.
Now you see all this stuff with ceramics and LEDs and this and that and everything else. And it's like different plants, some plants respond to like a different types of light and do well regardless. Some plants do phenomenal under one type of light. And then you move them and you think, oh, I'm going to put them under this and it's going to do great. And then they hate it.
Yeah.
Because they're not getting, sometimes you'd see people where they were growing all these straight HPSs and then they'd have straight up old school metal halides like hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the vertical ones?
Yeah. Vertical. Just to give, but I just mean,
like, I still got scars from those fuckers,
but just to give a different spectrum, like not to be the majority of it, but just to shine some blue.
Yeah.
So the plants had that to use. And you remember like the crusty buckets?
Yeah.
That guy swore if you didn't have 25% metal halide light, you couldn't get those kind of huge plants.
Yeah.
He swore if you had all HPS, you'd get shittier weed.
Yeah.
In order to get the size and the frost, you needed some blue.
Yeah.
And that's partially why the old HPS single-endeds, a lot of people considered them to be the best all-around light, and they were the standard, because they had 25% more blue.
Yeah.
You look at their spectrum versus like a double-ended right now that's HPS, and the HPS is almost all orange and red.
Yeah.
Very little UV, very little. And so I have a bunch of plants like my headband and my sours and dog and stuff, you know, and you grow them under different lights. I grew the dog once under pure ceramic.
Yeah.
I cut it at 85 days and it still had white hairs.
Yeah.
And you know what's weird is that I grew the dog shit under that same light. And it finished 2 weeks earlier than it normally would.
With a different spectrum?
Yeah. With the CMA. Normally the dog shit would go 12 or 13 weeks.
Yeah.
I grew it under pure 3100 ceramic metal halides. Uh-huh. It was done in 70 days. Every hair turned, fully ripened. I've got beautiful pics of it. It shaved 2 weeks off. But the same spectrum made the dog go 2 weeks longer than I've ever taken her.
Yeah, that's funny.
I've never taken the dog 85 days in my life, dude.
Yeah.
You know, she's 63 to 70 and she's pretty done.
Yeah.
But when I finally cut her and I gave up, tons of white hairs all over.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe like as a final thing, if you're trying to grow heads, spectrum plays a big deal. Food plays a big deal. Your style definitely helps. And like less is more.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, like just enough and nothing more is a better style than like, let's give it way too much and pump it. Let's supersize it. Let's get hot, you know, let's run hot. You know, that might give you better weight, but I doubt it'll give you better weed.
Yeah.
You know? And so, and that's a lot of times like what it happens is like whether it's drying or curing or growing or your nutrition or your environment, like growing the same strains over and over that are your favorites and learning why some rips, they come out amazing.
Yeah.
And some rips you're like, eh, you know?
Yeah.
Because even good growers get the eh runs.
Oh yeah.
Like, oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, people are still using shit other than LEDs. I think LEDs have come a long way. I'm still not convinced they're better than a blend of other light.
I still have never even tried LED lights. So if any LED light sponsors want to sponsor, I'll give it a fucking try. But I tend to like CMH quite a bit.
Do I think that LEDs are great for various aspects of heat? And have I started seeing a lot of nice weed under them? And do they have good applications? I do. But I still think some of the best heads you can ever grow are off an old school Hortolux single-ended bulb.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of award-winning weed and a lot of fire came out of that.
Yeah.
The whole indoor sour era, the whole indoor Kush era, the whole indoor purple era, all grown under those bulbs.
You know, I always hated fucking Hortolux. They had a chick that was running it, and they were so anti-fucking cannabis. It was retarded how anti-cannabis that company was and how much money they made off cannabis growers.
Yeah, I mean, it's prohibition. It's dangerous. There's a, like, we could wind it down, but I'll tell a story. So I live in Mendo. And one time, I was friends with the produce guy at our Safeway. Mm-hmm. And there was one point in Willits where that Safeway sold more organic produce than any Safeway in the country.
Yeah.
Because there was so many fucking of us, right? It was just unbelievable. Yeah. So this guy, he tells me this funny story of this guy from Reynolds comes in, right? Mm-hmm. Because this Safeway was the number one selling turkey bag store for Reynolds turkey bags in the entire country. We were number one. He couldn't believe it. They came out there to figure out what the hell is going on.
Why are people cooking so many fucking turkeys?
Why are people cooking? They had no idea. They were like, this zone, we have more. Like, can we spread what we're doing here to other parts? Yeah. Because our sales are through the fucking roof, you know?
Yeah.
And when they found out it was all for weed, like, the dude's face just, you know, he was just so bummed, right?
Yeah,
but it was like, because back then you couldn't get like turkey bags in 50 or 100 packs like you can today.
Yeah.
You would have to go to the store and like the turkey, they came in like two or three packs.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you had, you know, an indoor and 20 pound, you had to buy 10 boxes.
Yeah.
And then you're at the store, you know, and it's like buying like lube or something like that. You're like, you want to get other shit.
Why? I never got the turkey bag fucking thing because it's not like it really kept smells.
It was the standard. It was a bag that fit a pound. You could tie it. And like the thing is with fluffy weed, if you didn't get the bigger turkey bag, you could not have enough of a tail to make a knot and
off
seal
of a
it
pound. Yeah.
Off a full pound. So like, where do you get a bag that can fit a pound?
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a very good point.
You know, and it's like you grow Kush or something, or, you know, Urkel, you're going to get a tight pound.
Yeah.
Right. You grow Diesel and it's going to be like a tall pound.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an aspect to it where it's like it just became the standard.
And the days of fighting over fucking sizes of bags and weight.
Yeah. And so the amount, what's crazy is that like the Willits Safeway learned, and they just had, I mean, they would just buy immense amounts of the shit all the time. It was like such a huge seller for so long because there wasn't, eventually companies started making where you could go to the hydro store and you could buy like 25 or 50 or 100. And it was like something you could purchase there and not be so embarrassed. But you had to, back in the day, you had to just go into the grocery store.
Yeah.
That's where you fucking got it, you know?
Yep.
And that's how it fit. So, I guess we've been on, I mean, the reason why we wanted to chat about this is because we thought that, and we could get deeper into it. So you can always reach out to us on our Discord, which Matt will plug, or you can reach out to us on IG or whatever. But there's a lot of different strategies. I didn't want to nerd out too hard. But there's a lot of depth to what kind of weed you're trying to grow and what your goals are for it, right? And how you want to feed it and how you want to treat it. And it matters, you know? And so don't just look online at someone you think is killing it and just feel like, oh, I figured it all out. I don't have to ask any more questions. I'm good. I'll just replicate this one method. And I know all I need to know.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times there's a lot of issues with them. You know, so, you know, I mean, Matt, I'm not very good at doing the plugs. Matt, do the plug on the Discord and the whatnot.
You got it. So, our Discord, you have to go to Google, type in Breeders Syndicate Patreon, and that's how you find us. We have our Discord. We have all kinds of additional features at the Discord that we can enjoy together. We're always there shooting the shit, talking, fucking around, posting pics, just being obnoxious. I'm being obnoxious on there. I try to be as obnoxious as I can be. And we have riotseatco.com. I promise I'm going to get the Hawaiian Lights hybrids up. There's only three up right now. We were having problems figuring out why they weren't displaying, and hopefully that's fixed, I think. So hopefully those will be up there and you can grab them this weekend. My apologies for being late a week, or 2 weeks maybe, I think. What else is there? Speakeasy Seed Bank. All of our friends are on there. Go check it out. Go show support.
And I'll throw in a plug too. After years of not dealing with it, I have my follower list, and I accepted thousands of new people. I also rejected a shit ton of people. So if you got rejected, maybe, who knows? Maybe I was in a bad mood. Maybe you didn't have enough posts, maybe whatever. You can always message me and say, hey, dude, I listen, add me. You know, yeah. I'll try to keep up on it from now on. We're going to try to create more content. Basically, we're just trying to shoot the shit about culture, history, and growing better wheat.
Yeah.
And so you can always ask us questions. You can always hit us up on IG if you have ideas for shows that you might want to talk about. Maybe it takes us a while to get them, but you know, we want to talk about what you want to hear, you know, and so, you know, some of it'll be, can be user generated. You can always ask us longer questions and get better responses on the Discords, you know, and we talk about various subjects and things like that. And it's easy to get there. So, you know, we're trying to do our best. We're trying to do a little different podcast than most, or, you know, live or whatever. And just basically, like, you know, just have it be like a little bit about culture and life and growing and a mix. So, you know, thank everyone for listening on their Friday night. We'll be back again. Same time, same place, all that.
Want more Breeder Syndicate? Be sure to check out our Patreon by going to Google and searching Breeder Syndicate Patreon. We have a secret Discord where we are available at most times and interact daily. There are a lot of perks to be had there, so check it out. Need seeds? Check out riotseeds.com, where you can get our seeds and our reversal spray for making your own feminized seeds.